The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Please welcome Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
At the Democratic National Convention this summer, the towering vision of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar took to the stage and lent his support to the Democratic Party and its nominee.
I'm Michael Jordan, and I'm here with Hillary. I said that because I know that Donald Trump couldn't tell the difference.
Michael Jordan aside, and forget LeBron James and Steph Curry, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is still arguably the most dominant player in the history of college and professional basketball. In 20 years with the NBA, he became the all-time leading scorer, and since he retired in 1989, nobody has broken his record, not even MJ. But Abdul-Jabbar's so-called retirement has also been kind of remarkable in its way. He's set his mind to becoming a writer. He's the author of books ranging from memoir to African-American history to a kind of Sherlock Holmes reboot called Mycroft Holmes. His latest book is called Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality Beyond Black and White. The essays share his ideas of right and wrong, his love of history, and recently he told me why he chose this year to appear at a political convention for the very first time.
Well, I've been invited before, but I never really had the inclination to go. And I wanted to go this year because I thought that whatever happens in this election will be very important for our country. And I wanted to take part and, you know, say whatever it was that I had to say.
You didn't feel that way before?
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was that crucial. But given all of the manifestations of racism and xenophobia and just a whole lot of tension and hatred going back and forth, I felt that this year is crucial.
Why do you think this is going on now? We've gone through now, and maybe it's because of the advent of videotape and iPhones, because these incidents have been going on, God knows, for decades. But why do you think these police shootings, these manifestations of racism and xenophobia have come to this fever pitch in the last X months?
Well, I think that a lot of people are noticing a change in our country. We have a black president. More and more of the population are people of color. Seeing that change taking place and not being able to do anything has made a lot of people uptight. And I think Donald Trump recognized that and decided to take advantage of it.
As the world existed in 1967-68 and in the wake of Muhammad Ali's refusal to serve in the military, you decided not to participate in the Olympic Games.
Right.
The Olympic Games just finished. Would you have played in the Olympics as the world is now in 2016, do you think?
I probably would have. You know, there was a lot less incentive for me to forego the Olympics in years subsequent to 1968.
What kind of price did you pay for not playing in the Olympics?
Well, I got criticized a lot, but fortunately for me, I had another year of college ball to play, and the American basketball team won the gold medal in 1968, so nobody can blame me on the fact that they didn't win, and I just moved on.
Now, in your book, you try to come to grips with and begin a chapter with a wonderful quote from James Baldwin: "The most dangerous creation of any society is that man who has nothing to lose." You grew up in Inwood.
Yep.
And Inwood is by far not the poorest place in New York City, but you're cheek by jowl with it. You grew up aware of poverty and people with nothing to lose.
Yeah.
What is your sense of things now when you go back to your old neighborhood, when you go back, when you were in the inner city in L.A. or New York or anywhere else, that there are more people with nothing to lose than when you started out?
Well, I think it's unfortunate because America was going in the other direction. And I think that...
In a positive direction.
In a positive direction. And I think that we become too comfortable with mediocrity. American school kids now no longer lead the world in most academic disciplines. And that was the case for the longest time. And I think that's a direct failure of our school system. And our school system is failing because we don't want to spend the money to pay the teachers to do the great job that they did for so long. All of a sudden, it's okay that, you know, people aren't given the opportunity to get a first-rate education and go on to college. It's these kind of issues that really bother me, and it's what I'm talking about in my book.
In the opening of the new book, you write about being a black role model, about the frustration in, quote, knowing that although you are proof it can be done, like a happy lottery winner waving a million-dollar ticket, the odds are so astronomically against others that it sometimes feels as if you're more the source of false hope and crushed dreams.
That is a problem, you know, because black Americans who are able to overcome the odds and do well and be successful, people point to them as an example as to, well, why aren't all black people that successful?
Did you carry that heavily when you came into prominence, which was really early? I remember, you know, as a kid hearing about you, even as a high school player. Did you carry that weight very heavily?
I didn't carry it at all. I was going to do the best I could do, no matter what. I got to give my grandmother credit for that. You know, she was very much an advocate for education and discipline. And she felt that if you got an education and had some discipline, you could achieve anything. And I have to agree with her.
So at no point in college or as a pro player did you feel the burden of being a role model? You just felt the burden of doing your best as a ball player?
Yeah, doing my best and maintaining my grades, getting out of school. That was very important to me.
I want to get a sense of how you think about contemporary athletics today. You raised the question of paying college athletes. Nowhere in the world that I know of, nowhere, is college athletics what it is in the United States, either as a business or as an obsession. You go to Europe and start talking about, you know, the Fighting Gamecocks of this one or the Spartans of here. They just have no idea what you're talking about. Here you think the system ought to be changed radically.
Well, I think that the people who perform, the college athletes who perform, they're exploited. College athletics generates billions of dollars in revenue, and the college athletes don't get to share in that. People that run the NCAA have million-dollar salaries. Really,
to say nothing of the coaches.
Oh, the coaches are doing great. So I think that that's wrong, and some of that incredible amount of money should go to the athletes just to make their lives easier. I'm not saying that they have to be made wealthy, but they should not have to worry about insurance. They should not have to worry about getting hurt and losing their scholarship.
That argument comes up against the traditional argument of you would lose the amateur experience, you would lose the college experience. You think that's a kind of construction of hypocrisy?
Of course it's hypocritical. If the amateur experience was supposed to be so important, why aren't the coaches participating in it?
Yeah.
They're taking home millions of dollars a year.
In salary and in sneaker contracts and all the rest.
Contracts, all of those things, they're doing great. The athletes, if you get hurt and can't play again...
That's it.
That's it. And that's a terrible example of exploiting someone.
Did you feel this way when you were 18, 19 years old?
Yeah, I did.
Hmm.
And that's because, you know, one of the people that I got to know at UCLA explained it to me. He said...
Who was that?
His name was Sam Gilbert. He was a businessman who befriended me. He scalped my tickets, which enabled me to have a few coins in my pocket.
Now, if you had gotten caught for him scalping your tickets, you would have gotten in hot water, no?
I might have, yeah.
Yeah.
And he didn't care. You know, he felt that we should get some type of compensation for what we were doing. We were winning the NCAA every year. If you make it possible for the athletes to have a car and be able to take their girl out every so often, I think it would be a lot different, and the complaint wouldn't be so extreme.
Now, I wonder, are you a football fan?
Yes.
Do you have any problems with football? You watch football, you now know even more than we ever have.
Concussion system.
Concussions and people who play even a modestly long career, can barely get out of a chair, a lot of them.
I know a lot of those guys. A number of my friends that play professional football are dead. A couple of them died this year, you know.
Who's that?
Ken Stabler. Mm-hmm. Jack Tatum's dead. A lot of guys on the Raiders, I knew, but John Matuszak, he was a big fan of mine when I was in Milwaukee. And then, you know, he went to Iowa and then played for the Raiders. To see these guys die like that, I think those guys didn't understand what they were doing to themselves. Now that they have an understanding of it.
What can be done? Is football a fixable sport?
I don't know if it is. Because I think the concussions are inevitable.
Because what occurs to me is that pro football, all NBA to the side and pop music to the side, pro football is probably the most popular entertainment in the United States. Certainly the Super Bowl is the highest rated of anything. And if pro football is unfixable in medical terms, you're going to start seeing more and more kids not playing it, in the same way that boxing became a kind of marginal part of American pop culture, that pro football and college football may one day not exist.
Well, I'm sure if it doesn't exist in the future, it'll be for good reasons.
Is there too much money at stake, do you think, for it to be fixed?
I think the money is going to make it a lot harder to fix. But what they've learned about the concussion issue, I think really will make it at least a little bit more humane.
I read a pretty scary article in ESPN magazine in which Larry Bird was talking about the health issues that come to men of a certain height. I think a number of former NBA centers have died in the last several years.
Nate Thurman, Daryl Dawkins, Moses Malone. I could go on.
And what does that tell you? When you talk to doctors, what is that all about?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of guys, once they've stopped their professional career, they stop going to see doctors and don't see these things creeping up on them.
Because athletes think of themselves as so perfectly
attuned to everything and able to perform at a higher level, so their health must be okay.
Did you relish retirement or did you fear it? Was it a difficult transition?
I kind of relished retirement. It gave me a chance to get close to my children and getting over the burnout. That took me about 3 or 4 years. Then I got interested in writing again and realized that I had to do something for
a
the rest
crazy
of my
obsession,
life.
Writing.
Yeah, but it's fun. And I wanted to do it.
Is there anything as satisfying? After you retired, is there anything that can match athletic either achievement or triumph?
I think there probably are things that can match it, but it's really tough. It's great, and the whole nation watches you, and you have fans and friends all over the country.
But that's something that always seemed you had a certain ambivalence about, the whole nation watching you.
Yeah, I did. I wanted the opportunity to excel, but I also felt that it was also a lot of pressure. But, I was able to handle the pressure and do well.
I'll say so. Kareem, thank you very much.
Well, it's been great talking with you.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, writer and master of the skyhook. His new book, co-authored by Raymond Obstfeld, is called Writings on the Wall. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Coming up this hour, a cinematographer makes a movie about herself. And Ariel Levy, volunteer psychedelics reporter, talks about taking drugs on the job. But it's okay, because I don't think the experience was all that much fun.
This girl leans over and lets loose the Victoria Falls of vomit all over me. All over me. I am covered.
You'll want to stick around for that.
vomit.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.